Motopod, proudly supported by Roadskin, a UK label specializing in protective outerwear for motorcyclists. Modern biker clothing that you can wear all day long and engineered to save your skin. For the road, for life, visit roadskin.co.uk. Welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 777, the last of the great Boeing aircraft, because everything after that is probably junk. Or the doors fall off or something. Anyway, this is not an aviation podcast. This is a motorcycle podcast. I'm Jim McDowell. With me, back from holiday, Richard Jowett. Richard, hopefully you had a great holiday, I hope.
Certainly did, Jim. Yes, Mauritius. Highly recommended to anybody that can ever get there. Beautiful place, beautiful people, just nothing bad to say about it, really. It was just a holiday of a lifetime. It was our silver wedding anniversary treat to ourselves after 25 years of marriage, obviously. So, yeah, really, really enjoyed listening to you and Skylar talking again, Jim. It was great, kind of throwback thing. We should do a little bit of this more often, I think. Just get some of the old hosts back on from time to time if we can. So, yeah, all good. Really good, but glad to be back.
Yeah, it's good to have you. Good to have you back. Good to have the normal guy back there to Skylar. Although many thanks to Skylar. It was great fun to sit down with Skylar and talk again and go over the racing and do all that as we had in the old times and whatnot. So it was very nostalgic to be back. And hopefully we'll have Skylar and I have been planning. We got a couple little things that we want to do, more off season fill in kind of thing. So we got some ideas floating around. So hopefully those will work out and pan out and whatnot. So some ideas that we had. So anyway, that was all good and fun and all that good stuff. But we've had a new subscriber to the show, Rich. If you could kindly help us out there and go through all that, it'd be great.
Yeah. So I'll just handle the PayPal subscribers first. So we've got Gareth Locke, Jacob Nurkow, Carl Hun, Rick Taylor, Nori Ito, Nick Saban, and Alan Fleming. And then on Patreon, we have, I don't think you mentioned this on the last one, Jim. I'll just catch up anyway. Michael Cowan has come on as a Patreon subscriber. So, Michael, thank you very much. Good to have you on board. Joined by regular contributors now, Brenton Edwards, Scott Baldwin, Ollie, Dennis Kindig, Jeremy Burnich, Jacob Rower, more of him in a moment, Darren Andrews, Paul Lang, Gary Chavit, and Steve. So, guys, thank you, all of you. The financial contribution is obviously massively important and very much appreciated at this end. The more of you that can do that, the better. So on we go.
Thanks for the update, Rich. So as we said, Jacob has written into the show here, so we'll do a little listener feedback. It's a quick one. He says that I made him laugh twice in the last show. Once when describing the two F1 tracks in the US as appalling. Yeah, well, they really are. So it is funny and apt, as Jacob says. And he says, then again, when using the British term for beating someone late in the race as pimped, apparently it's pipped. So again, you know, I'm an American, so I speak American. I don't speak English. That's why Rich is on that side, so that he can speak the proper English. So yes, I guess it is supposed to be pipped. I thought it was pimped, although, you know, if you walk through some of the big cities here in the U.S., that's definitely not the right term. So I guess I should have thought about that. But anyway, Skylar and I were having fun. Apologies if that offended anyone. Didn't mean it that way. And hopefully, like I said, hopefully Skylar and I will be able to come back with some off-season shows together as well. And thank you, Jacob, for the words. And I'm glad that I could at least make you laugh. So
that's what we're here for, Jim.
Oh, that's what I'm here for. Yes, I'm here to make everybody laugh. That's what I tell people at work. I am here for nothing more than the comedy relief that I bring to the job. Anyway.
Jim, can I just cut in? Because Jacob finishes off by saying thanks for all the effort, which is obviously appreciated, that sentiment. And the interviews are great. On which point, I have a lot of interview content to put out. Obviously, I've still got the Donington stuff as well as the Silverstone stuff. I'm going to busy myself over the next couple of weeks. I've been on holiday. Work has gone swivel-eyed bonkers crazy for me over the last month or so. that's going to remain the case, not necessarily in a fully positive way. But anyway, I'm going to get my head down and get this interview stuff out. Most of it is kind of not time sensitive in terms of news, because it's more about sort of themes and just a bit of a deep dive into people's kind of careers and stuff. So hopefully it's not too time sensitive in terms of when I recorded it as to when we put it out. We're running into a busy sort of, what's this, the last third of the season, MotoGP
Yeah,
wise now. So,
12 races in 9 weeks.
yeah, it's a lot.
It's a lot.
So
Or nine
obviously we'll
races
try
in
and,
12 weeks, whichever it
yeah,
was.
we'll slot stuff in as best as we can, but content, it's content at the end of the day, whenever it comes out. And it's good stuff that I got from Don and Tanan from Silverstone, but I will get my head down and get that stuff out now. So yeah, look out for that coming hopefully fairly soon.
All right, with that, let's go to some news that broke from the weekend in Aragon. It is very likely that the Pramac Yamaha will be Oliveira and Miller, so there will be no seat for Garcia there. We'll come on to the Garcia issue a little later on. But does that surprise you, Rich? I mean, it doesn't really surprise me. I mean, Miller was a surprise to me. I really thought Jack was going to leave the MotoGP paddock, but Oliveira going there doesn't really shock me all that much. I mean, I don't know, it just didn't work for him at the satellite Aprilia team, if you want to put it that way. So I think he would much rather go to Pramac and have good factory bikes, which is but are you part of it is it because Oliveira is good at setup? Is he good at development? Are those pieces of the puzzle that Yamaha wanted, so Yamaha's extending him the contract, or is it just truly Pramac? Who knows in that deal? But your take, sir.
Well, my take is I'm either one of those two guys. I fully endorse them being there from the point of view of their experience, particularly on other bikes. But I'm rather surprised that Pramac haven't taken the opportunity to take a young gun from Moto2, which obviously taps into the whole Garcia thing, because I personally felt that he would be, a shoe-in there, really. And I'm rather disappointed for him that he's not there, to be honest. So, Miller, I get Oliveira, I get, although I think both of those probably in truth have slight question marks about them in the sense that they've been very up and down in their careers. To have both of them there, I get it from an experience point of view, but I can't help but feel it's a bit of a missed opportunity for Yamaha. Obviously, Yamaha in that kind of next 2 to 3 years, certainly as we go into 2027. They do need good quality technical input, and both Miller and Oliveira will provide that without a doubt. But you've got Rins, who's hard to know really what's going on with Alex Rins. As much as I love him as a rider, he is still my favourite rider, but obviously still quite badly injured, and so we've not seen the best or the worst of him on the Yamaha. And Quartararo, okay, we saw at the weekend he's still got the fire burning, so he will always turn in a result. But I just can't help but feel that they could have done with, a bit of a future-proofing element to this four rider lineup on works bikes. And so for me, it's a missed opportunity. But what do you think, Jim?
I don't know. I mean, if I'm Yamaha, and I have some say, if I have some say on who are the two guys that are going to be riding at Pramac, I would want experienced hands for at least a couple of years, because I've got to get myself out of this development hole that I'm in. Plus, I need to have an all new bike essentially for 27. I would really want them along for the ride for that too. But that help prevents you from perhaps capturing or putting under contract good young talent that will be maturing and you will need later on. As sorry, Father Time will catch up with Oliveira and with Miller. That's just what happens. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit strange, but it's their show and they're gonna run
You
it
can
their way.
see why they've done it,
Yeah.
but for me, the problem that they might find is that by the time they get to 27, 28, all four of those guys might be kind of looking at, heading off into retirement. Maybe not. I mean, I don't see any of them going into superbikes at that stage of their careers, but they'll probably see out MotoGP and then, go up and enjoy their well-funded retirements. But I just find it slightly odd that Yamaha is not looking to bring some talent through that will take over from those guys once they depart. But however, as you say, Jim, they've got some very experienced hands that will get through the next couple of years, go into 2027, hopefully with a package that works better, and then they can bring the young guns in at that point. So it kind of makes sense whichever way you look at it, I suppose. But I was just a little bit surprised.
All right, let's go to the second point here, the 2025 Ducati factory bikes update. I think you penciled this one in because I'm not sure
Yeah.
what your thinking is
So
here, so.
I, in the show before I went off on holiday, I was kind of getting a little bit tongue-tied and confused about who was on 2024 spec bikes this year. And then obviously we were talking about the fact that Ducati had announced that they were only going to have three works bikes for 2025. So just to make sure I was clear in my mind, I got in touch with Simon Patterson just to double check my arithmetic on this one. So effectively this year you have Bagnaia and Bastianini obviously on 24 spec bikes in the works team, and both Martin and Morbidelli are on 2024 bikes this year as well. Next year you will have Marc Marquez and Pecco Bagnaia on 25 spec bikes in the works team, but only Fabio DiGiantonio on a 25 bike in the VR46 squad. So Morbidelli will stay on the 24 bike. So just to clarify what I thought was the case, there are four works bikes this year, and Ducati have decided to drop to three bikes, fully factory spec bikes next year. So that's just to clarify what we had spoken about before. And they are, my point going back a couple of episodes was that I was slightly surprised that Ducati had decided to do that, given that Aprilia, Yamaha, Honda, etc., are all fielding at least four factory bikes through their works teams and then their supported satellite squads, KTM being the other, obviously. So I was just scratching my head a little bit as to why Ducati would seek to do that at this point of utter dominance. Or maybe that's why they're doing it. They don't need to put four bikes out there, but it just seems an odd decision to me. But I just wanted to check that I was correct in my assumptions there. So it is only three 2025 spec bikes that will be out on the grid next year from Ducati.
Well, I mean, maybe they're preparing for Marquez to trash a few along the way.
Well, crash
Okay,
damage will be a part of the deal, I'm sure. Yeah.
right. So we got that straight now,
You
which is good.
cynic.
I would. He Marquez has crashed quite a few bikes. He tends to do that.
He
He
does.
just simply tends to wad them up into gravel traps. He just looking for the edge, and sometimes there's no ledge beyond the edge that you can grab onto, and he just does that. So maybe you're just pulling it in so they have, what all the materials that they need. Because technically, if you think about it, Ducati would have to, has to build six full factory bikes at a minimum, because everybody gets two in the factory team, right? Because you got to have a bike for a wet or flag to flag race. So that's an interesting take on that one. So let us turn our attention to the Moto2 class for some news and notes that came through. Big one here, Mark VDS is going to drop the KLX chassis that they currently run and are going to go to the Bosque Cura speed up, whatever you want to call it, in 25. It's amazing. Nobody wanted that chassis. And as soon as somebody wins on that chassis, everybody's like, oh, I got to have that chassis now. Interesting. I think a lot of people looked at how well Agura and Garcia adapted to those bikes and how easy they made it look. And I think everybody else is struggling for some reason. Now, whether it's the stiffness of the KLX in comparison to the Bosque Cura or vice versa, whichever way it is, and how they work with Pirelli tires. That's sort of, I think, the biggest deciding factor is that those bikes there. Although the KLXs do seem to have come good here now. They've had more than enough time now to sort of sort through any setup tire combination things that they had to sort through. So it's just interesting because now that'll give us what, four, six bikes on in under on the speed up, I think. Because you
Possibly more if we come to one of the next items. Yeah, but interestingly, Jim, without wishing to preempt what we're going to talk about in Moto2, I believe it's the case that Bosque Scura brought a new chassis to Aragon, and
Okay.
quite clearly, not everybody was very happy with the change. So, just to prove the point that things do change rather quickly in motorcycle racing, and where the Kalex was not the bike to be on before, suddenly they seem to be turning things around, and you know, perhaps confused a little bit by Posca-Skyria maybe changing some of their setup as well and parts. So yeah, we'll come to that.
So the rumor I heard was that Lopez was a possible replacement for Arbolino at Mark VDS, because Arbolino doesn't have a contract for next year through Mark VDS. He's going to go someplace else. And you've got in here that Dixon is in possible talk to go to Mark VDS.
No, it's official.
It's official now. Okay, so since the time that I wrote the notes on Monday, they've made it official that Dixon's going to Mark VDS.
Yeah.
He's leaving Grassini.
And he replaces Tony Arbolino. Yeah. And so,
interesting.
I'm trying to think who the other rider on Mark VDS is. I think it's Philippe Salach, isn't it?
Yes, I believe so.
Somewhat kind of...
Let me look
not
here.
Not absent physically, but absent in terms of the coverage and the results. I think he is obviously on a contract that keeps him in place next year. So Dixon is definitely going to Mark VDS next year. Okay. So I don't think Lopez's destination. I mean, I suspect he will stay put on the Posca-Skyria squad because there isn't anywhere to go in MotoGP now, obviously. So it would be odd to think that he would go anywhere else. So I'm pretty sure that that's, you know, correct as of the time of recording, Jim.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I really didn't think Dixon would leave Grassini, but I mean, hey, it is what it is. I mean, there. That's kind
in
of
the context of what's happened in the last few races. I mean, again, you don't know how long these negotiations go on for, and certainly if you go to the first half of the season, everybody would be looking to go to Posca-Skyria, both in terms of teams and riders. Now, whether that will remain the plum option as we go into the second half of the season, who's to know, because Dixon's just had his fourth podium on the Kalex and won the last race, as we'll come to. So, I mean, these things ebb and flow very, very quickly, don't they? Nothing stays still in life, and certainly not in motor racing terms. So, well, there's no room at the inn in MotoGP for Jake Dixon or Joe Roberts or any of the others that aren't confirmed there. So I suppose the deck just shuffles as it shuffles every year. But yeah, time will tell on the wisdom of that move.
Yeah. So Arbolino then is supposed to go to the Monster Camp Yamaha squad, who are theoretically going to have Boscacoras speed ups next year, which is interesting.
Pretty sure I heard that mentioned on the commentary as a, not as a confirmed thing, but as a strong rumor that that was likely to happen.
So I'm trying to draw lines where there aren't lines because there's just dot points out there. Does that mean that Yamaha is looking at Arbolino as a potential one of the younger guys to move on to either the Pramac squad or, you know, slot in next to Quartararo? Because that would kind of work, because he'd be on the Yamaha team. There'd be a sort of a direct line to getting on one of those bikes. But I don't know. I mean, that seems like a weird choice to do. I mean, Arbolino was a great Moto 3 rider. Hasn't had a great Moto 2 year when he finished second to Acosta. But he did slump in the second half of the season. Let's be honest about that. And then he's really not found a good run of form on Pirellis.
Up until recently.
Yes, till like right now. But
yeah, the last two, maybe three races, you would say. I mean, I think
the last two.
I see Arbolino's position as very much akin to Joe Roberts and Jake Dixon in the sense that they've been in Moto2 for quite a long time. In terms of MotoGP, the grid's not going to get any bigger. And the riders, you know, for one reason or another, there are many reasons in terms of the nuance of the way the championship works. But, you know, the riders in MotoGP hang around quite a long time. I mean, let's go back to, I don't know, let's go back to GP500. I mean, people were injured so badly so often that they weren't in the class for that long. So there was always a kind of a through route for new people to come in. We're looking at people like Aleix Espargaró, who are kind of retiring because they've just had enough now. Rather than being forced out of the sport, they just decide to go. And allied to that, you've got so much talent in Moto3, sort of champing to get into the next categories up, that there's just no room at the inn for some of these guys that have been hanging around in Moto2 for quite so long. So I think, for me, as good a riders as they are, and they are obviously world-class talents, the likes of Jake Dixon, I say with a heavy heart, Joe Roberts, from your point of view and your fellow Americans, Jim, and Arbolino. Not that Italy's got too much to worry about when it comes to MotoGP stars to follow, but in comparison to the Brits and the Americans, for certain, I just don't really see a route out of there. I thought, if you remember, that Arbolino was quite likely to get called up to MotoGP, possibly to Gresini, a year or so ago. And obviously, Marc Marquez suddenly then popped into that spot and kind of disrupted the market, as he has continued to do ever since. So, yeah, it's hard to see, really. I just feel that these guys will probably see out the best of the rest of their career in Moto2, and then they might drop into one of the other championships, World Supers or national championships, perhaps. But don't know. That's just my thought.
Interesting, interesting. Oh, okay. So if we move on, the Thailand in Buriram has been confirmed as the opener of the MotoGP season for the next 2 years. So we know first race, Buriram. So that's where we'll be. We'll be in Thailand for that. It's probably a good move because that separates the East, the East, Southeast Asia leg into different things instead of going, what, Japan, Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, kind of a
Malaysia.
thing. Yeah, so that's sort of, and then on to Australia. So that sort of separates that up, which I think would probably a good thing. We also learned that Aldeguer will ride for 2 years at Gresini. Okay, well, where else was he going to go? Your de facto number one Ducati satellite team would ditch you for Yamaha. So okay, you went with the guy who's the Italian who runs the team, runs another team. Well, sure, let's just give him the de facto number one status at there. And hey, by the way, well, hey, guess as a parting gift for Gresini, we have for you one Firmin Aldeguer. And so you get to have him on your team for a couple years to get some seasoning and some time on a year old Ducati, which is probably not a bad thing for Aldeguer. Aldeguer is fairly young. He's still, what, 20? I think.
Yeah, he's really, really young.
Yeah,
Yeah,
he
and
still might be 19. I can't remember.
a
Either
few of
way.
the kind of well-known journos are kind of saying that perhaps it might just be the case that the degree of pressure that's been on him to win the Moto2 championship this year might just be all a bit too much, and that a couple of years sort of slightly under the radar as a very, very young guy still at Gresini might just be a good thing for him, just to sort of settle down, learn his trade on the bigger bike. But I was making snarky comments, and not snarky in the sense that I don't like Aldeguer, because I really do. Super guy. Spoke to him, if people remember, interviewed him in Qatar last November. Just he's a great guy, but this year has been a bit of a horror show, really, hasn't it? Given the amount of expectation, rightly or wrongly, the expectation, but he did do four on the bounce at the end of last season. Therefore, expectations were high this year. But there was the Pirelli thing that came in. Maybe he hasn't adapted to that the best, and he's had a bit of bad luck. A few other things that have been a bit weird, crashing in the long loop penalty in Barcelona. A few other sort of odd things that have gone on this year. Again, Aragon, we'll come to it. Not the greatest moment for him. So I think, he's got the contract. There's no way Ducati are going to let him go. So, I mean, he's not in danger of losing that ride. But Gresini is probably a pretty safe, and I'll use the term relatively, sort of under the radar place for him to sort of just, get up to speed again.
Sometimes the weight of expectation is a lot. It weighs on you. You have to perform and you don't. And it's tough. It's really tough. I mean, there's I can't say that I've really had like a whole lot of expectation ever put on me when I was racing, but you had those moments. There were those moments when I was much younger, I'm talking like 10, 11, 12 years old. It was like, hey, you're racing the local short track. You're doing really well. Oh, and hey, here's the chat. Here now comes the track championship race. Well, you're sort of the favorite to win this thing because you've won a lot of races earlier. Well, if you don't win this one, what's going to happen to you? And you feel it, right? I don't think you feel it as much as a kid. You're just having fun, so you don't care. But it's definitely, for someone who's trying to make their living as a professional motorcycle rider, that weight of expectation can be absolutely horrifying.
Yeah, and never mind the amount of expectation that he puts on himself,
Oh yeah.
which is an enormous amount of pressure in of itself. And I mean, the move that we'll come to at the weekend did rather smack of a degree of desperation, really, albeit a split second decision that went wrong. But we'll come to that, obviously.
Yeah.
But
Let's definitely come to that because I have a different side, perhaps, than what you have to
cool.
that one.
Okay. Excellent.
So, excuse me. This is the best news of the entire news, in my opinion. We go back to Brno for 5 years. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I'm like,
Brilliant.
yes. That track is one of the best motorcycle tracks I think that you have on the calendar. Heck, I think that
Yeah.
track would be brilliant for WEC. It'd be brilliant for Formula One. I think that track is one of the best. It has no clunky chicanes. It's in the, it follows the natural terrain of the valley that it sits in. And then if the everybody says, oh, horsepower hill. It is. It's a huge climb out of the valley to get there, to get back to the top. And then I guess technically the last two turns are a chicane, but it allows someone to get a draft, to get in there, sneak up the inside, but it also it's so wide you can actually run too wide through the next turn and you can have a really great drag race to it. Plus, it's the place where Biaggi almost flipped a YZR Yamaha backwards doing a wheelie. I mean, why not? Why not go
Yeah.
back? I don't know. Why did it ever drop off? I mean, I guess obviously probably money. I don't guess there's a backstory here somewhere that I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was money. The track surface was becoming a problem. I think that remains a problem that needs to be dealt with before they go back next year, but it's under different ownership now. I mean, it is, a double width version of Phillip Island in Europe, as far as I'm concerned, and it is certainly equal to Phillip Island, I would say, as I mean, you summed it up, Jim. It follows the contours of the land, and it's just a great, great place. And it is the best news we've heard for quite some time. And I am desperate to go next year. I'm planning in my mind, bearing in mind that I don't know when it is yet because the calendar hasn't come out. I believe the 2025 provisional calendar is going to be released this weekend at Misano. So I'm eager to know when Brno is going to fall. I'm assuming it will be sometime during the kind of July, August period, because that's when it historically was held. And I don't know if you covered it. I'm just trying to remember if you covered this with Skyler on the last show, but bizarrely, Silverstone has been moved to May.
We didn't cover it on the show. We talked about it, I think, the
It's
prior one.
possible you and I spoke about that in the previous show.
It's
That's an
bizarre that it's
odd
in May.
decision to me. I mean,
Yeah.
May in the UK can be very nice, but equally it can be pretty wretched as well. So I don't understand the rationale for that decision. There obviously is a rationale for the decision, but if that means that Brno lands somewhere early August or mid-August, whatever, probably somewhere close to Austria, I would guess, given geographical proximity, then that works for me. I've got the BMW K1300S primed and polished outside. So that bad boy's going to be getting a ride across to into Eastern Europe if all things go well next year, Jim. Trust me.
I like it. I like it a lot. So last bit of news. Well, two things left here. Chantra is going to ride at Idemitsu LCR Honda, assumingly, well, not assumingly, he is replacing Nakagami because Zarco has a contract still. So yeah, that one's a, I don't know. I'm not really sure what, I'm not sure what I think about that one. I mean, part of me says that Chantra has had a couple good wins in Moto 2 on, I'm not going to discount that, but He's going to MotoGP, which everybody wants to do, which is great, and I'm happy for him. But what is he providing to Honda other than maybe, the Idemitsu part of it, right? The Asian connection, or the, that.
It's a semblance of credibility for the Asia Talent Cup. And I get, the Idemitsu kind of sponsorship thing. They want an Asian rider, or a Southeast Asian rider on the bike. So I understand that. But like you, Jim, I mean, there was all this kind of bitching and moaning about Joe Roberts kind of getting a passport kind of base ride, which obviously didn't happen in the end. And you kind of feel the same. I mean, nothing against Songkhla Chantra, but his record in Moto2 is patchy, to be fair,
Yes.
and poor if you're going to be a little bit more stern about things. And on top of which, the kicker is that the opening round of the season next year is where? Thailand.
Thailand.
His first race on a MotoGP bike. I mean, that is going to be a challenge for the poor lad. I'm really interested to know what the listeners think on this one. Nothing against him. I mean, he has won a race in Moto2, but I think he's only won one race, maybe two. I'm struggling to think. I mean, he's not a serial winner. He's not even a serial podium contender. And the fact that, for whatever reason, contractually, politically, whatever, the fact that Aegira has slipped through the net as far as HRC are concerned, kind of left them, I suppose, with nowhere to go. I mean, I personally felt with the Aegira going to Trackhouse news that that was pretty much meant that Nakagami would stay put. And I would have thought, given the choices, that would have been the safer move, to be honest. Again, being a little bit harsh towards Chantra, but I think that's a challenging career development for him. But, every rider wants to be on MotoGP and he gets his chance. And who's to say he won't grab it and do really, really well? But, and I hope he does. But yeah, I'm fearful.
Yeah, I tend to think, and let's be honest, Chantra's probably, I probably wouldn't be in the same zip code with him when I was in my prime racing bikes. Okay, he's an immense talent. There's no question about that. But we're talking about elite motorcycle racing here. I can't help but think that he's like a sponsor ploy kind of a thing.
On a bike that is, let's
Horrible.
be honest, trying to, well, severely injure its riders all the time, irrespective of where they are. So this is not a Pedro Acosta level talent that we're talking about. If he were, he wouldn't have been a Moto2 for what, 4 or 5 seasons.
Yeah, something of that nature. Yes, he was there for quite a while.
So that's my kind of fear factor a little bit, is that there's so much pressure on him given his nationality and the sparsity of people that are in that position on that bike starting off in Thailand. I just hope he doesn't injure himself
Yeah.
immediately, because that's the risk on that bike.
Well, last thing from testing, or last thing is about testing, and that is the fact that the test calendar has been released for next year. We have the traditional day after the last race in Valencia. Then we have a Sepang shakedown test. Then we have the Sepang test. Then we're going to Buriram to test, and we're going to be there the 12th and 13th of February, which I think then you're going to either have a very early, like February 26, 27, 28, start to the season, and then kind of move 2 weeks later to Qatar, which would put you in that like March 10th, 11th, 12th kind of idea. So, it's going to be interesting because when we saw what happened to Portimao when we tested there and then went to the first race of the season there, that there was all kind of shenanigans and chicanery and all kinds of things that went sort of sideways with people getting their shoulders broke and people running people off the track and everything, because everybody had it all dialed in. So I'm fearful that that's what's going to happen when we go to Buriram. Everyone's going to have it dialed in at that point in time, and then they're going to turn them loose to go race, and it's going to be a little bit of pent up anxiety there that everybody's just going to freak out again. But who knows? You have any thoughts on that, Rich? Don't care.
I mean, I don't really see that there's any difference to testing at Qatar and then having the race at Qatar. I mean, I'm assuming that Qatar is not the first race because I'm guessing Ramadan and Summit might be dates-wise interfering with that traditional, recent traditional opening slot. So, I mean, it'd be make a nice change to go to Thailand for the first race. I mean, it's never happened before, so that'd be pretty cool. I don't personally like the fact that they test at a place and then immediately have a race, in the same way that I hate the fact they're going to have a race at Misano next weekend, then have a test, and then have another race there straight afterwards. I just think that is a recipe for boredom, really, particularly given how MotoGP is inclined to be at the moment. So I've got my enthusiasm in check, but very much offset by the fact that we will be going to places like Brno, to make up for it in terms of a place that nobody's been. There's no pre-test there, and therefore that will be an exciting voyage into the relative unknown for most of the riders at Brno and maybe a few other places. I think there's talk about a race in Hungary next year.
I haven't heard that one yet.
Kazakhstan apparently is going to happen, although, hold that one for the time being.
At least
India,
we're getting out of
possibly
Spain
back again. Well, yes.
Although Aragon did get a 2-year deal.
Very thin crowd at Aragon this weekend, though.
They had over 100,000 for a race that wasn't really going to happen there. And then to have everybody have 107,000 people show up for it, I thought was decent.
Well, it's all right.
That's better than COTA numbers.
Well, it was about the same as what Silverstone achieved this year. So, I mean, Aragon is literally in the middle of nowhere, I think, as well, relative to some of the other Spanish venues. So it's probably not bad in that context. But, yeah, nothing against Spain, nothing against Italy. But if we had a little bit less Spanish and Italian influence in terms of races and riders, I think that would be, for me, for the general betterment of the sport. Let's just leave it at that.
That's a good place to leave it. Let's go to the racing from the weekend, shall
we? Let's go to races. Yeah. In Spain, ironically.
We found out that it does actually rain in Spain, too.
That's true. Yeah. Occasionally. Yeah.
Occasionally. Oh, okay. Let's talk about Moto3 qualifying. There's nothing really going on in the first qualifying session. Everybody who's in the championship chase, everybody who's in part of that, is clearly as easily into the QT session. So there wasn't really anybody there that you didn't expect to be there, except for maybe Forsato was the only person who potentially was there, but he did get out. So Bertelli, Furusawa, Farioli, and Ogden actually made it into the second qualifying session as well. Rolston in the second qualifying session, he had a very nice high side at turn three. That was a very good one. I mean, you know, these guys were working hard for that. Halfway through, Alonso was out front, then Kelso, Ortola, Bertelli, Rueda, and Piqueras. But when it came down to it, nobody could beat David Alonso. He would qualify number one, followed by Rueda, followed by Munoz, Piqueras, Kelso with another strong qualifying effort, Lunetta with a very good qualifying effort. I mean, he's getting over the injuries that he had, and we're starting to see a lot of the talent that he has and the reason why he is on the SICK 58 squad team, and he gets the honor of being like first Honda, so you can't really discount that. So that was your top six there. To finish out the top 10, it was Holgado, Bertelli, Vire was ninth. Vire did not have a very good qualifying session at all, and 10th was Ortola. So it was like the guys that were out front in the championship were, except for Alonso, but like everybody chasing Alonso was going to start poorly here. They just couldn't put it together or whatever. I'm assuming this is Vire's first time to Aragon. I'm assuming because he would have had to have raced in the CEV at some point there, I would think.
He must have.
He would have had to have.
Because anyway, we didn't have an Aragon last year,
did we?
No, okay. Just a slight side note, Jim. Last week, did you and Skyler talk about the fact that Vire has been confirmed in the Aki Iaio Moto2 squad for next year?
Yes, we did.
Okay. That is a great position for Vire to go to, isn't it?
Mm.
Really great.
I mean, and to go there.
Because I'm going to forget it. The other thing that I thought was very pertinent that you and Skyler spoke about was the enigma that is David Munoz.
Yes.
And you were talking, I think Skyler mentioned the fact that he's kind of like this very sort of up and down figure, as would be the case in this race. And he is exactly the sort of guy that needs an Akiayo in his corner to harness that talent, that undoubted talent that he has. But it's a wayward talent, isn't it? And I see Vaya as he's not a wayward talent at all. His problem in Moto3 is that he has to manage his tires so much, I think, because of his physical stature. So, as we are finding with Denis Onchu in Moto2 in that IO squad, I think Vaya is going to be dynamite. Anyway, getting ahead of
Yes.
myself,
Oh,
but
no,
yeah.
you're fine, because I agree with you. I completely agree with you. He Vire got the plum Moto2 ride. If you look at all the teams that are in Moto2, right? And since we're in Moto3, let's talk about Moto2, right? So we ramble around. But IO is like the team. Like, it's right there. It is the top. You know, after that, you kind of try to figure out who is like the next best team. I would put probably Mark VDS second, then I would put Grassini after that. But then you'd also got to put the MT Helmets MSI team in there as well somewhere. So that's like the top four teams, really. But there is IO is a cut above everybody else, I think, regardless.
I think that is basically true. Yeah.
All right, we were in Moto3 land.
Sorry.
So
Yeah,
no, it's fine.
I'm catching up. I'm catching
It's
up on stuff
okay.
that I listened to last time out, because I was back to being an old Motopod listener from the days gone by, where I was just listening to the show rather than taking part in it, and it was great, you know. So, and I thought, oh, I must mention the Munov thing, because that really stuck in my mind. Because, yeah, he really needs some direction, that kid, and you know he's moving out of the Boé squad, I think, next year, like Kelso is. And you did say where he's going, and I've forgotten, but it's not to IO, which is kind of the place that he, for me,
Needed to
needed
go,
to
yeah.
go. Yeah.
And he didn't. Okay, so we moved to the Moto3 race. So the theme of the weekend became these thunderstorms that would roll through in the night. Like, before qualifying, it had rained. And it was so bad that the poor Moto3 guys, when the first guys out then that morning, they came back in looking like they'd been motocrossing on their bikes. They were so dirty. So that threat of rain persisted. It was probably even worse on race day morning. So it was like, wow, we're going out with like a very green track, and the track has been resurfaced. And the combination of the rain, the dust, the dirt, all that got washed on, washed off, the removing of any rubber that was down previously led to a rather crazy Moto3 race. But like, crazier in a different way than the normal, like, hey, let's have a 10-pack rider, which is, this is the one odd. You've got a very long straightaway in Aragon. And we know at other tracks that have long straightaways, it's a pack ride. But Aragon doesn't really produce a pack ride of Moto3 bikes, which is interesting, because the first part is twisty enough to break everybody up. And you've got to be able to hit your mark, and you've got to be able to be consistent and all those things. But anyway, what's interesting is how it starts off. I think the only person who was on a hard rear was Rueda. I think everybody else went with the soft because the track was green and everybody just wanted to get the best traction they could. But Alonso gets off the line very quickly, followed by Rueda, Piqueras, Luneta, Holgado, and Kelso. Alonso, by the time they hit the back stretch, had a 1.5 second lead over everybody else. So in the distance of roughly, what is that, 12, 13, 14, in 15 turns, he had a 1.5 second lead. It was obvious that Alonso's idea was to go out front, just run it as hard as he could, build a gap, and then manage the tires for the rest of the race. Which was great, because then that meant that as Alonso got away, we got to see some great racing that was happening in the pack. Before the first lap had even been completed, Kelso had made his way to second. And once he got there, he promptly patted the back of the seat to show everybody, hey, stay behind me, and we're going to go get Alonso, because in case you guys were not looking up track at all, Alonso is 1.5 seconds ahead of us. And if we don't try to catch him and work together, we may not be able to catch him.
Can I just ask, Jim?
Yes.
Why does any rider ever tap the back of their seat? Because it literally never works, does it? I mean, it's almost red rag to the bull for anybody that's behind.
Did you ever do it? Yes. The only place I've ever done it was on the mile at Springfield, and we were dirt tracking. So it's mild dirt at Springfield. And this is kind of where, to me, this is normal, because this happened in Grand National Motorcycle Racing all throughout the 80s and the 90s. And it is not as common today, but in that time when I was a kid, you go to the Nationals to see it, it happened a lot, because what would happen is you'd get a couple guys that would hook up in the draft and run together on the mile, which is really super critical for, you know, bikes that literally have no aerodynamics whatsoever on them. And they would tend to get away, and they would just run off. And you had this little grace period of about 2 or 3 laps that you could jostle around for, say, third. And if you guys didn't get in line, the two guys in front were now going to be uncatchable. You weren't going to get there. So guys on the mile would get by, and they think they'd have the speed. Maybe they would just point to the back like, hey, stay with me. Let's stay in line, and let's figure out how to get to the guys in front. And if they would, the next three guys would sort of wind up catching in a lap or two the two guys that were out front. So you brought everybody back to having pack racing. So the only reason I ever did it was we were out the mile at Springfield. We were running our 600s out there, and you had to be third to go to the main. And I was running in a pack of 4, 5, 6, and the 1, 2, 3 guys were you could tell were getting away. I had finally had made a move to get to fourth, and I did that same thing. And the guy behind me realized that we could go somewhere together. We actually did claw up onto the guys that were running 1, 2, 3. And we caught him at the last, turn 3, the end of the backstretch. We caught him there. And of course, young, inexperienced Jim didn't realize how powerful the draft is. So I go in there way too deep, right? You know, buzz around the cushion on the outside and don't transfer. But anyway, that's the slap on the back of the motorcycle seat story for you.
So it can work then.
It can work, yes.
It can work.
It can work.
Just rarely ever does in Moto 3.
Yeah, I think it has more to do with Moto 3 is the fact that I don't think it really works much in road racing anyway, just because of the fact that you got all the turns that you're trying to stop for and then accelerate to and from and back and forth and all that. Where on a mild dirt track, it's kind of like a flywheel, right? If you can just keep that momentum going, you will eventually just keep going faster and faster and faster.
Yeah.
Because you finally get yourself either you've got yourself figured out how to run on the groove, or you got yourself right there at the edge of the cushion and you're just running around and you're just going faster and faster and faster, because really a 600 and even to some extent the 750s at the time when we were dirt tracking, you could almost hold them wide open all the way around Springfield. I definitely held my 600 wide open all the way around. You just didn't let off unless you got sucked into the corner by the draft, in which case I forgot the let off. And anyway,
so sounds terrifying.
It's actually thrilling. That's like people say, which one did you like better? Did you like dirt tracking or did you like road racing? And I'm like, there's something very magical about going that fast on a mile on dirt. There's also, and it's like, okay, that's really wild. There's also something really kind of crazy about running on a half mile up on the cushion and be like a foot away from a set of hay bales, which is some weird, cool thing too. I guess it's for the more crazy of us out there. And then what about road racing? Well, that's fun because there's a lot of speed and you're dragging your knees. And if you go through very long arc radiuses and, the idea of just going that fast with your knee on the ground is mind boggling. But then if it rained, that was even cooler because it's now just nothing works and everything's just going all wiggly and whatever. Anyway, we were talking about Moto 3, right?
Sorry.
It's okay. It's like
not usual.
So anyway, hopefully you guys enjoyed that little story. But anyway, we had just gotten through first couple of laps, and Fernandez had worked his way, Adrian Fernandez had worked his way up to get past Kelso to go to second. Vire at this point was eighth. So after two laps, Vire is only eighth. Furusato worked his way to third by the 14 laps to go. Kelso went backwards to sixth, and Furusato made it all the way to second place. Piqueras crashes at the corkscrew because, again, the line, there was so much dirt offline that you were running on that, I'll call it a 3 meter wide line. And if you got anywhere outside of that 3 meters of line, they talked about it being like ice, which is really probably the best description that you can have. You have no traction. And as Simon Crafar said, this is a great way of putting it, the bike doesn't go anywhere because it spins. It doesn't stop because it has no grip. And it doesn't want to turn because it has no grip, which is all valid points. And literally, there's nothing you can do. You feel like you're just being the, you're just a passenger on the airliner, so to speak, at that point.
I think also, Jim, it's just worth pointing out. I mean, most people that listen to this show will know this perfectly well for themselves, but there's this concept of a green track after rain, i.e., the rubber off the racing line gets kind of washed away a little bit, so it reduces. But at Aragon, it was worse than that. And I'm sure you get this in the States all over. We get this in the UK a bit, and in Spain, it will be definitely a problem, particularly in Aragon, which is, as I say, quite isolated in a very sort of arid surrounding area. So when it rains, there's a lot of dust in the rain. So if you get overnight rain, you just get a lot of dust that once the water has evaporated, you have a film of dirt on the track off the line as well. So it is super slippy. So this idea of dirty rain, you've got the kind of combined thing that the rubber gets washed away and you get a load of dust in places as well. And whilst, as you say, you've got this 2-3 meter kind of groove that's okay if you move off it, and we saw this a lot over the weekend. You've got nowhere to go but down a lot of the time. So, yeah.
Very, very true. Five laps into the race, Vire had made his way to third. So from eighth, he's now third. Then he moved into second. Then Furusato is going backwards. So like, what problem does he actually have? He lost his pace. He went backwards to third. Lunetta then moved past him to be third. So Lunetta is having a great ride in essentially tricky conditions. Again, this is a 3 meter wide groove. Got to be sure that you stay there. Now, Alonso is way down the racetrack. He's like 2, 2.5 seconds down the track. Honestly, I thought Alonso is gone. Like, this was a masterstroke of genius by the kid, in my mind. Hey, you have pole, you have an advantage, you're starting on the groove, you're going to be leading. Just go out there and ride as hard as you can and let the chips fall where they may. Because no one may be able to catch you. Because if anybody starts fighting, they're going to slide off, get their tires dirty. It takes a turn or two to clean the tires back up. So I thought brilliant race strategy by the kid, And sure enough, all of a sudden, here's Vire, who is now taking tenths of seconds out of Alonso. And you're looking for the pit board, looking for him to, for Alonso to respond, and he doesn't. It's just this is now consistently Vire taking time out of him. It's like, ooh, Vire, sort of the master of the tire saving effort. Perhaps maybe Alonso's tire is gone. And we found out they had a shot, great shot. The left side of that Pirelli rear was shagged. It looked bad. So I was like,
It did.
okay, there's a serious grip problem for this kid on the left-hand side. And well, with 10 left turns, that's going to be tricky to deal with. So I was like, ooh, the race is on now because we now know Alonso is in trouble. But we didn't know what anybody else was or where they were at that point. Kelso had sort of stabilized at fifth. He got by Forsato. Rueda was way wide at 11, and then he wound up just piling it on, and he got past Lunetta. At this point, you got to think, I'm thinking, wait a minute, Rueda might be in with a shot here maybe because he had the hard tire. And if everybody else's tires was going to look like Alonso's tire, well, maybe the hard was the better choice to actually have if you could make it work or if you were patient. But Rueda was still a long, like long way off of where the front guys were. But he was making some progress. At six laps to go, Vire got by Alonso at turn three. And then you looked and it was Rueda and Lunetta were coming. These guys were coming hard and fast. They were starting to take 5 tenths out of people a lap, which that in Moto 3 is uncommon, unheard of, but it was one of these weird things that happened that allowed them to start taking these massive chunks of time out of it. Boom, they were together, and it was a four-rider battle for the win at this point. But Lunetta would get by Alonso for third, and then Rueda would get by Vire. And with three laps left, it was Rueda leading, followed by Vire, followed by Lunetta, followed by Alonso, Kelso. Ferrosato had basically settled for his fifth. He wasn't going to try anymore. But Rueda would ride home for the victory, his first victory, showing us the talent that he had to be the only kid to win Red Bull Rookies in the Junior World Championship in the same year. And so the kid had a great pedigree coming in, but we've never seen it again. You know, poor guy had the appendicitis in COTA, had to have the emergency surgery. He's finally back from all that. He wins that race. It was a great race for him. Vire would hang on to be second. Lunetta finishes third. Alonso, you know, terrible race for Alonso. He's fourth. The world has come crashing down. You know, poor kid. You gotta feel sorry for him. Kelso with a strong ride to finish fifth. As we said, Ferrosato had settled for sixth. Munoz with his up and down was seventh. Then Zuratzua has gotten himself in at eighth, which looked like a great ride for him given the circumstances. Helgardo ninth, then Bertelli, Fernandez, Ortola 12th, then Nepa 13th, Suzuki 14th, and the last point was scored by Esteban in that. A great, fascinating, different strategic kind of a race, a lot different than what we usually see in Moto3, which is just go for it kind of a thing and then figure out how to draft by somebody at the last lap or whatever. But this is a good one, Rich. Just different.
It was a, what's the word? Kind of captivating, I think, is probably the word for it. Because, I mean, Alonso, like you said, Jim, on at the end of or halfway round lap one, had, as you said, had a 1.5 second lead. And you're thinking, oh my God, he's just going to be 10 seconds up the road by the end of this one. But weird that his tire went in the way that it did. But again, who knows? I mean, all Alonso in those, well, in that first half, 2/3 of the race, all he could do was just lead at the front because he had a good start. There was a bit of kind of jostling in the pack behind him on the first few laps, which kind of helped him to stay out front. So for whatever reason, his tire just went. But Rueda being on that hard tire was just a masterstroke. I don't know if that was his choice or the team's choice, but it kind of won in the race. And it's worth noting that he's the 400th Grand Prix winner as well, all time since the championship started, which kind of seems like not a big number to me. You'd have thought that more people would have run a race over since 19, what, 50,
49.
49 was it when it started? Anyway, because I kind of wrote down Alonso. I'm a big, big fan of Alonso. I mean, he's clearly, he's a massive star of the future. I mean, he's a massive star already, but kind of champion's ride. He kind of rallied a bit towards the end and secured that fourth place, which was a good result. When we look at the points, I mean, he's handsomely in front. So fourth overall, when you consider how odd that weekend was, is a pretty good result for Alonso. But my standout is Lunetta.
Yes,
You know, he
agreed.
qualified, where was he? He was sixth on the grid, coming back from an injury. He missed the last race, I think, or the last, certainly the last couple of races. And that's his first podium. He has been knocking on the door all season, looking good. I'm interested to see now that he has that podium. This is always the bit that interests me in terms of the mentality of a rider and the team and the galvanizing effect that that has around a rider and a sort of a potential star in the making. I'm really curious to see where he goes from here, assuming he stays fit. He's coming back from an injury, as we just said. But great weekend for him. I mean, full disclosure, I didn't see any of the qualifying, any of the practice because I was away at the weekend on a family do. So I got home late Sunday afternoon. Ignored your WhatsApp message, Jim, just in case it was telling me the result of the MotoGP race. So I was busily binge watching all of the races Sunday afternoon, late afternoon, sort of Sunday evening. So yeah, I didn't kind of see what happened through practice and whatnot to get him onto sixth place on the grid. But certainly that third place finish was very, very impressive. And I'm a little bit of a mini fan of Lunetta at the moment, and I'm kind of curious to see what he does through the remainder of this season.
It's hard not to be a fan of just the SICK 58. Well, how is it? It's SICK 58 Corsa.
Squadra Corsa, is it?
Squadra Corsa, thank you.
Yeah.
It's hard not to be, just because it's sick, and sick's that, right? I think it's hard not to be. And you know, Lunetta's a great, hopefully the next, I don't want to say great, but the next budding young Italian talent, right? And he seems, in his interviews and stuff, he seems thrilled. He seems very, you know, personable, you know, sponsors kind of like that kind of a thing. And, you know, he seemed kind of down to earth too. Like, hey, look, I know I'm just now getting over my shoulder injury, I think he had. And hey, you know, hopefully this is the beginning. Hopefully we can carry some momentum. You know, he says all the right things, but, you know, I think you and I have now interviewed enough riders and in the MotoGP paddock to realize these guys are very well coached in PR speak and whatnot. So they're never going to really let you in on things. But that being said, I was impressed that Lunetta, I mean, on a difficult racetrack, to finish where he finished, he cooler heads prevailed and he wound up in a podium. Perfect.
And he goes to his home round where he's got two shots at it coming up. So this will be interesting to see, you know, mentally and psychologically, how he deals with both the ecstasy of having got his first podium in Moto3 World Championship racing and the pressure of going into his home round, because that tells you a lot about the future potential of people. I mean, it's interesting what you were saying about Rueda. He came into Moto3 last year, didn't he?
Yes.
As kind of, well, not kind of, the replacement for Pedro Acosta. And that was an incredibly difficult position to fill, let's be perfectly honest. But as you say, Jim, he was Red Bull rookie and junior Moto3 world champion at that stage. So he came in with all of the pedigree and then kind of, probably a bit unfair to say underperformed, but didn't kind of do a Pedro Acosta level job in his first season. And then this year he had these health problems and some injuries and stuff early in the season. So this first win's been a long time coming, but again, it'll be interesting to see how he pushes on forward from here. Because you have to say, at this point, the likes of Holgado, you kind of wonder where they go from here in terms of this season and beyond, in terms of whether they go up to Moto2 and stuff. And the other sort of notable one was Ortola. You know, let's not forget, he's been running rampant behind Alonso, really, in terms of pushing Alonso in terms of the points and getting a few points back here and there, but had a very poor weekend. I mean, where did he finish? I think he was like 11th or 12th.
Ortola was 12th. It was
so a poor result for him, given where Alonso finished, despite Alonso's troubles having led for so long. So, yeah, I mean, let's come to the championship positions, which I'm sure you'll run us through.
Yes.
But overall, you have to say Alonso came out of the weekend looking pretty good.
Yeah, he did what he needed to do because he maintains his championship points lead. In fact, he expanded it ever so slightly over Vier. Alonso sits on 237 points. He is a full 75 points, three race victories ahead of Colin Vier. There's talk of Alonso clinching in Japan, which he could do conceivably. He wins a couple of races. You know, if he wins two races in Italy, and I don't put it past him not doing that. I mean, you know, I think it'd be like, you know, easily Japan slash Thailand slash Indonesia, he's going to be world champion. There's just no one's going to really catch him.
He's going to win three or four races still this season, isn't he? And isn't he the most winningest rider in Moto3 now, behind Fanati? In front of Fanati, who had way more years in Moto3.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the level of talent we're talking about.
Yeah, it's crazy. The kid wins or finishes off the podium. I mean,
yeah.
It's just bizarre. But Ortola was passed by Vier because he's now 5 points behind Vier, but he's 80 points behind Alonso, that's starting to become monumental to replace. You just can't see. I mean, anything can happen, but you just don't think it's going to happen with Alonso. You just think he's just going to do his job, do his thing, and that's going to be it. Holgado's fourth on 156. Then it's Munoz. Rueda with that win jumps up to sixth. Then it's Adrian Fernandez, Yamanaka, Kelso 9th, and then Piqueras is 10th. And that's Moto 3. So, anything else for Moto 3 before we dive into Moto 2?
Only what I've been saying all year, which is it's remarkable how few crashes there are in Moto3. So nobody's really losing big
Yes.
points, are they?
I put it down to tires. I put it down to the Pirelli. The squishy foam Pirelli gives a better feel, and these guys know it for longer. And I think it's a more controlled breakaway feel. I
Yeah.
think that the Pirellis have feel, 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 feel. Oh, it's getting really bad, but I'm still good. Okay, now it's gone.
Yeah.
Whereas the Dunlop was sort of a, hey, grip, 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 gone. There isn't
Nothing.
that, there's not
Yeah.
that warning. There's a warning in there with the Pirelli that I think these kids really, really like. And
Yeah.
it's just the different nature of the construction of the compounds of literally of the profile of the tire. I mean, this is years ago, the last time I seen looking at, Pirellis and Dunlops. Dunlops front are very triangular, very, very triangular. Pirellis are triangular, but there's way more of a bigger arc going on in there than there is on the Pirellis. So
And
I
historically with Moto3, what we would see is that, as we still see this year, in general terms, the pack stays together and then things go a bit kind of crazy on the last 2 to 3 laps. When that happened in previous seasons, the Dunlops, with their lack of predictability, people would high side or just crash for whatever reason with, trying to go in on the front end or whatever. We're just not seeing that this year. And I just think it's, as you say, Jim, it's just a much wider operating window. Even on low grip at the end of a race, people can manage it. So we're not just not seeing the attrition rates that we used to see. And that's why, partly why, we're seeing such a big gap, I think, for Alonso, who is super consistent. So yeah, I mean, you might say that perhaps it's been to the detriment. I don't know, but I like to see the cream rise to the top personally. And Alonso over the course of the season has just been spectacularly good. So anyway, still a way to go yet, but hard to see major changes as far as I'm concerned.
yeah, just kudos to Pirelli jumping in, taking the contract. And I mean, not, I'm not here to bash Dunlop. They're a fine tire. They're just, Pirellis are just different, and they have
Yeah.
given us different racing. Who knows? Next year, everybody's got a year on Pirellis. It may be a completely different thing. We don't know. But as of right now, you can't complain about the racing. That's for
All
sure.
good. Yeah. Okay. Moto2.
Okay, Moto2. We get to the first qualifying session. Arbolino is there. Aguirre is there. Baltus Bender. Garcia is there. What? Why is Garcia there? This is the guy who's there. It's like, okay, I wasn't ready to throw up alarm bells at this point in the game because we've seen him qualify kind of poorly, Silverstone being the most recent example that I could throw at you. But it's like, whoa, okay, that's all right. Well, let's see how this goes here. As we go through, Arbolino had a moment at turn 13. Masi went down. Navarro high-sided himself at the top of the corkscrew. And again, there's no room for error here. We're talking there is no margin for these guys to be able to take this. And ideally, these guys had the best track to deal with. They had all of MotoGP qualifying. They had all of Moto3 qualifying. And and they had temperature. They had the best shot of having the best track to qualify on, and these guys were still going crazy. Then Garcia high-sided in turn 7, just and it just the rear just steps out and it just flicked him. He was just done, and he stayed in the gravel trap for a little bit. I was a little worried, but I think he just got sort of the air knocked out of him. But what we have now with Garcia, and this is the point we were kind of alluding to earlier, he has a crisis of confidence. He has been overlooked for not one, but two MotoGP seats, and he can't seem to comprehend why he's not there. He can't figure out why anybody else is better than him, given the status of what's happening, especially considering that Aguirre got a ride when he's basically been the better of the two riders in that particular team, which that's a tough one to think to go through. And he literally has this crisis of confidence right now, where even the team has said they're working hard to help him understand what's going on. And like, hey, look, your future's still bright. Just got to put some results in here. Be a Moto2 world champion. Force people to understand that you are a great rider and that you do deserve a MotoGP ride. You can't sulk about it. I mean, I don't know if he's actually technically sulking, but I mean, just metaphorically that's kind of the impression you get that the team is trying to stop. Is there anything that you want to say about that, Rich?
Well, only in the sense that I'm kind of pinching somebody else's viewpoint on this in terms of, again,
discredit them.
Simon Patterson, who had a different take on this, which is that, I mean, Garcia was a pretty accomplished Moto3 rider, and I'm sure he was a very accomplished rider in the junior categories before he arrived in the World Championship. So it's not that he's not used to dealing with pressure. I mean, human nature being what it is, clearly the talk around him potentially being in line for MotoGP seat, that's bound to have weighed on his mind. I mean, I don't doubt that for one moment, but from what Simon P was saying was that Garcia himself was pretty irritated at the team, insinuating that the MotoGP stuff was kind of messing with him. And going back to what I alluded to earlier on, I think the bigger issue, if you look across at least 50% of the Bosque Escuras, was that they brought a new chassis to Aragon, and it clearly worked better for some people. And Garcia, perhaps with other things weighing on him, just couldn't get his head around it. So I think my inclination is that probably just it was a combination of factors, not really the fact that he was kind of sulking or upset about the MotoGP thing. That's bound to have been a part of it, because there's nuance in all of these things. Of course there is. It's not a zero-sum game. You know, there's never just one thing that's to blame. But the insinuation was that Garcia didn't get on with the new chassis. I mean, Lopez had an okay race. Aguirre, with his injury, had an okay race, probably was the best performer of everybody given that injury. And Aldeguer will come to in a moment, which is another kind of curious 2024 kind of Aldeguer performance. So, and Garcia, I mean, it was a horror show really on Sunday. I didn't see the practices and the qualifying, so I hadn't sort of spotted the fact, or wasn't aware that he had a big crash in qualifying, which is why he was obviously so far back on the grid in the first place, and just made no progress at all during the race, and then parked it. So, which is not a good look, really, under any circumstance, you know, to come in and park it. But he had a long lap penalty, which he didn't serve. And I was thinking, well, does he have to serve that at the next race, or does it get wiped off? That I don't know. And not great for Garcia. Again, I've said many, many times on this show, I'm a big fan of Sergio Garcia, but that was not a great weekend, all in all. And again, one can only hope that both he and the team and Bosque Escuras as a chassis provider, maybe they go back to the chassis that they were running before.
Yeah.
Because he's been doing pretty well on that. So hopefully things turn around a bit in Misano. But the other thing I just wanted to say, Jim, is that, you know, the Calyxes en masse have been getting better as the season has gone on. So maybe the Bosque Escuras riders and the MT Helmet squad in particular have kind of, I don't want to say flattered to deceive, but maybe they've just made the best of the early running. And now the pressure is piling on now that other people are getting fit. I mean, Dixon's not been at the races for the first third of the season because, of course, he had that horrendous crash in Qatar right at the very, very beginning. And, you know, Arbolino's taken time to get up to speed, et cetera, et cetera. Roberts has been there or thereabouts. And, you know, just the wave of the Calyxes is coming back a little bit again now. And so that's adding more pressure as well and kind of costing points for people. So, I mean, for me, this season, Moto2 is by far and away the best championship in terms of the racing and the intrigue off track as well.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. So with that crash, at best, he would have started 25th. He wound up starting 29th in the grid because Van der Gerberg, Arbolino had towed each other around for a great last lap for those two guys to get one and two and go through. And Agüero and Salak went through as well. When you got to the second qualifying session, halfway through, it was Morera, and then it was Arenas, Kennett, Dixon, Ramirez, Lopez. We changed tires. They come back out. It was Dixon who winds up taking the pole. He just pipped. Not pimped. Pipped.
PIPPEZ.
Yes, he pipped Murray, pipped Marrera to get the pole position. And then Ken, then sorry, then it was Marrera, Kennett, Onchu. Onchu was having a great weekend on the bike. They asked him, well, what are you kind of after qualifying? Like, what are you doing? He's like, well, nothing. I'm just riding. I'm not hurt anymore. Which is he did start the year with an injury, and it's taken him some time. But again, here's a kid running around in, the IO team. And IO has been very careful to tell him this is a learning year and get your footing and do your thing and work your way up and whatnot. All of a sudden, boom, Anshu is suddenly like, whoa, he's in the show. And I kind of felt that Anshu would do well on a Moto2 bike. I took him a while longer, but there are injuries. Okay, so we can, you got to kind of excuse it. But for him to qualify fourth, I thought it was great. But then, then it was Arbolino, Arenas, Lopez. Joe Roberts would get to eighth. Vietti was there. Then Gonzalez, Audiger would be 11th. And then Ramirez was the last one at 12th. So that's how things qualified. So then we go to race day. Again, we rain overnight or whatever. But Dixon gets away with a hole shot, followed by Arbolino, Marrera, Onchu, Audiger, and Roberts. Roberts had a pretty darn good start because basically anybody who wasn't on the groove, who would have been what you would call it, rider's right on the outside, away from the pit wall. Anybody who was closer to the pit wall had a worse start that was there. Roberts made the best of where he was because, being in that eighth place spot, he was able to leap up quite a few places. At least a couple there to get in there or whatever. But we had Guevara crash at turn three. Iagura was off track and that caused a slipperiness. Now, Canet and Lopez had a little coming together. Then they were trying to straighten it all out as they got down to the corkscrew, which is eight, I think. Starts eight, nine. Yeah, eight, nine. Yeah, eight, nine. And then Kinnett just goes in there and it's like a skating rink. The back end just goes out, finally gets grip and plots him over to the high side and down. The look on Kinnett's face was literally like, well, who hit me from behind? Sorry, Aaron, no one hit you from behind. That was just all you. Dirty tires, small groove. Again, didn't work. It wasn't the heat of the day, right? We still were wet patches that you could see on the track for Moto3, for the Moto2 guys. So that was crazy. So the start is kind of mangled, kind of crazy. But in the mayhem, Audiger got himself to second. Then Arbolino went by Dixon for the lead for a little bit. And he Arbolino led for a few laps there. But it was a nice group of six riders that were kind of jostling for the win there. And then Dixon went back in front. Then Anshu was there in second. Anshu had got by Marrera. Audiger tried to go by Anshu at turn 14. And Audiger had this massive high side. They actually caught it from the camera. I was on the inside of the corner. You see the whole thing. He just tries to back it in there and it just goes away from him. It gets so far that it finally just grabs and it was just woof, flicked him like a proverbial matchstick. And down he came. Audiger's race ran at that point. He was.
So you had a different view in terms of what was going on with this crash, Jim, you said earlier on. So I was insinuating that perhaps it smacked a little bit of desperation, but you have a different view.
I don't think it was desperation. I think that Audiger thought Anshu would be faster into that corner and it caught him out because Anshu was checking up. We were still pretty early into the race at that point. We'd only gone about four laps. I think Anshu was playing the long game and was making sure he got everything up to snuff. And that section of track was really slippery. Even in the MotoGP race, that part of the track was really slippery. I think Anshu was just tentative, and he was just more tentative than what Audiger thought he was going to be. So Audiger closed the ground quicker than he thought he was going to, and that required him to kind of go for a little more front brake, which I think started the problem because then the front kind of slipped and he let off of it. Now he's trying to save it. Now the back end's coming around. He's pivoting it. Then it just got away from him there. I don't think it was desperation. It's possible it was desperation, but I didn't think so when I looked at it. I still don't think it either. I just think it was the closing rate was just there. Just Anshu was not going as fast through that section. And if you look at the previous couple of laps, Onchi was losing a little bit of ground in that section. I mean, if you think about it from the MotoGP standpoint, like Marquez was dominant through that reverse corkscrew. And Jorge Martin, you know, who now gets to see Marquez's data, said, dude, I'm losing like 0.4 there. I don't know how he does it. I don't know how he goes through it that fast. So there was something more. It was more, to me, racetrack, just the conditions. I don't think it was, you know, Audegar had been announced that he was going to ride at Gersini. He really, at that point, I'm not so sure that you don't necessarily want to go out on a bang, but it just didn't smack of desperation for me. That's my
No,
take.
it's no, perfectly valid, and quite possibly that's the way it was. I mean, it's Bosicchio versus a Kalex through those turns as well. They have slightly different approaches as chassis through there, and as you say, I mean, it's slightly reminiscent of what would come, and that we will come to in terms of Bagnaia and Alex Marquez. I suppose these things happen so quickly, and with all the time to sort of think about it in retrospect, it's easy to come to conclusions. But the reality is that these things happen in an absolute split second. So maybe he just overcooked it, was kind of caught out, as you say, Jim. I mean, clearly, what was very obvious from the kind of camera view was that that rear end came round on him really quickly, and there was only one outcome really from that. And it was a nasty crash, actually. I mean, it was good that he was able to get up and walk away from that relatively unscathed, I presume. I mean, we didn't really see or hear much more about it, but yeah, just what an odd year Aldega's having, really. And I guess from his point of view, the end of the season can't really come soon enough, really. And then he can just sort of hopefully settle into a slightly calmer, slightly less pressurized inaugural campaign in MotoGP. Anyway, yeah, interesting.
Dixon and Arbolino have like a 1.1 second lead on the chasing pack of Lopez, Moreira, and Onchu. Roberts would then punt Vietti off at turn 16. Now, my first thing was like, well, I wonder if Roberts is going to get a penalty for this. And the only real view that we saw of it was the onboard of the rear camera, the camera on the tail section of Vietti's bike that's facing forward. And Roberts does really just ram it on in there. I felt like that was a racing incident, and I didn't think it deserved a long lap penalty, but it did get a penalty. Which, given the penalty, given what happens in the next race, I got to look at that as an inconsistency among the stewarding for this one. So I was not. You know, look, it wasn't going to affect Robert's race. Like, he wasn't anywhere near the front, wasn't going to be near the front. And so, again, Roberts has another opportunity when Garcia is nowhere to gain points and has completely just either run a streak of bad luck or is just that's just his maximum velocity they can do. And, you know, I think there's a way to look at it as there are good riders who win a race or two, then there are great riders who win lots of races and but maybe not a championship. And then there's the championship winning riders who are fast, who win races and win championships. And they're sort of that elite group of eliteness, you know, the
Yep.
elite of the elite, if you will, the aliens, to use maybe a better term. But
They maximize everything, even if it's not everything that's available,
yes,
sort of
agreed.
thing, if you know what I mean. They just take the maximum they can get all the time, relentlessly.
Yep. Garcia got a long lap penalty. You know, basically he doesn't, he just pulls it off, calls it a day, shows up there. Onchu wound up being like all over Lopez at the towards the end of the race. Roberts gets the long lap for responsible riding, so his fifth place was gone, which would have been good for him. He wound up coming back out in eighth, just by the virtue of having to go through the longest long lap that exists anywhere in
Yeah,
racing.
big
And
time.
then, you know,
Yeah.
yeah, so that was painful to watch. Just good Lord. But you know, Dixon is never really headed at this point. In fact, he kind of started to pull a lead there at the end. You know, he starts to get the gap. And basically, Dixon goes on to take a win. Fantastic race by Jake. I think this sequence of Jake that we've seen over the last 2, 3 weeks is the Jake we would have seen all season long, except for the, the bad luck of the injury that started at the beginning of the year. Arbolino would then be second in the race. Anshu would get to the podium, which was amazing for him just to be there. And then you had Alonso, then Gonzalez, Chantra, Ramirez, Ayagura, then Binder, Vietti, Salach, Sasaki, Baltus, Van der Gerberg, and then Mario Aggi taking home the last point in that race. Anything for the race, Rich, before we talk about where we are in the championship with these guys?
Well, you seem to have slightly fortuitously skated over the fact that Roberts smashed himself up on the last lap against his teammate Ramirez.
That's true.
What did you make of that?
Stupidity.
Apparently, there's not a lot of love lost between the two of them. No. And when Roberts served his long lap, rightly or wrongly, he came out immediately behind his teammate Ramirez. And correct. They then went on for, what, two or three laps, I guess, at that stage?
Yeah, it was on the last lap.
To take lumps out of each other. And it resulted in, again, I don't want to overstep the boundaries of what I know versus what I kind of suspect, but Roberts looked like an angry rider at that point. And how can we say this charitably? I think that was an ambitious move on the last lap. And yeah, I mean, a bit like Aldega, really, it just all went wrong very, very quickly, didn't it? And he had quite a big crash, was lucky not to injure himself worse than he might or might not have done. I don't know how he was, but he looked okay, let's say. But that's kind of game over, really, I think, psychologically for him, given the track house thing. I mean, talking about riders being affected by what's been going on off track. So, yeah, I kind of, I do genuinely feel sorry for Joe Roberts. But as I said earlier on, I see him very much in this kind of Vietti, Dixon, Canet. I mean, where the hell Canet goes from this weekend, long term, who can say? I mean, he's just so inconsistent. He's very, very fast, but I mean, that was a horror show on the lap one from Aaron Canet. So yeah, I feel for Joe, but I mean, I don't know really what else there is to say other than a couple more seasons, maybe if he's lucky in Moto2, and then probably Moto America, maybe World Superbike. Can't see the MotoGP thing ever happening, as indeed I think probably would be the case for Jake Dixon, which, you know, I say is a Brit with a heavy heart, because we have, like the Americans, we have, or the United States Americans, we have nobody representing us in MotoGP, and that's a big shame.
Yeah, everything you said about Joe's second crash is correct. It was a desperate rider trying to get back to any kind of points for a mistake of his own making, or a stewarding mistake. Take it for what it's worth. Either way, you put yourself in that position to begin with, because guess what? You could have been third in Silverstone. You threw it away. Think where you'd be now, Joe. Anyway, you should know that dirt track is won by being consistent week in, week out, and you have not been able to accomplish that. His time in the MotoGP paddock is now limited. He has a ride for next year with American Racing. I don't see him doing any better this next year than he is this year. And after that, he's going to be, because I think Joe will be 28 next year. So that's getting long in the tooth when a lot of people are 21, 22 getting onto a MotoGP bike. Not to say that it can't happen, but I think everybody sort of made their moves for who they want. And he's not on anybody's list anymore.
Yeah.
Despite what his passport says. So then the question is, where does he go? Is he going to go over and join Gerloff and World Superbike? Maybe. I mean, Joe seems to enjoy Europe, where most of the other American riders don't really gel with it. Maybe because he's Californian, maybe because he can speak Spanish fluently. I'm not sure. It's just different. But Joe could come back and race in Moto America, and then we'd have the old guys club, because Bobier, Gagne, Heron, and him would all be, almost all of them would be 30 or older by then. So
really interesting what Skyler was saying, and I'm super interested for your off-season show about Moto America that you hinted at maybe doing, because as Skyler said, Moto America, as good as it is in terms of that top sort of five or six guys, none of them are going to be around for a great deal longer. And where is the talent in terms of MotoGP route anyway. Where's the talent coming from in the States? And you could, with some utility, say the same thing in the UK, other than the fact that we have a very dynamic British Superbike and all the support classes series in the UK, a lot of which talent goes into World Superbike, which, as I've said many, many times before, is kind of criminally, and I'm pointing this one at Dorna, criminally kind of under promoted, underfunded, whatever you want to say. I personally think, when you look at World Superbike, it is a great series and it should be much, much better than it is. And I sort of lay the blame for that at Dorna's door because they're in charge. They're the kind of the series rights holder. But anyway, parking that to one side, the Brits have a route to sort of world championship stardom through there. Whereas, I mean, yeah, okay, you've got Gerloff, and I know Garnier showed up for a couple of
Twice.
seasons in the sort of the Honda camp, but the Honda was not in a good position. I mean, they're not in a good position now, but they were worse then. So it looks a bit grim for kind of American riders, in certainly from a MotoGP standpoint, doesn't it, Jim? Because where's the next superstar coming from?
Don't
Where's the
know.
next Nicky Hayden?
Don't know.
Because I mean, that's the last guy that you had, and I mean, that was 2006. I mean, that's a long time ago now, when he was world champion, at least, anyway.
Well, I've always felt I consider Spies the last American champion because he had the 2009 Superbike Championship. And Spies probably would have won MotoGP. Just he got stuck in the Lynn Jarvis train. Now let's that buzzsaw. Let's not go there. Let's just say Lynn Jarvis and I are not Christmas card friends, okay? Let's
And
just put
I
it that
mean,
way.
Spies kind of was so beaten up with his shoulder injuries and
Yeah,
stuff that
it
that
just
could
would
tell
pop
his
out.
career.
Yeah. His shoulder was done. It was, but anyway. Hey, let's try to get through this. So, Sergio
Sorry.
Garcia, no, it's okay. Sergio Garcia has n scored no points. So, he's on still on 162. Ayagura collected a few points to bid on 150. He's only 12 behind. Alonso Lopez is only 30, 29 behind. And then Roberts is 32 behind, but Roberts is. Yeah, he's wasted his opportunities to be where Agüero is. Dixon, if he can keep this run of form going, and if Garcia can't figure out the new Bosque Corrá, I give Jake a chance. In the riders that you mentioned there, I would take Dixon out of that. I think he has way more show-upness than Canet, than Vietti, than Roberts, than anybody else. I think, personally, I think you shortchanged Jake on that one when you put him in the list with everybody. But hey, I get it.
I'm only saying that he's missed his chance in MotoGP because I just
Oh,
don't see
sorry.
I just don't see an opening for him. I mean, I don't know that I could say that he is an obviously fully deserving person that's been passed over. But his form at the moment, if there were some seats open as we went into this last third of the season, might get attention of one or two teams, but there isn't any space left in MotoGP. That's my point. So I just think he's going to miss out. But there's no doubt. I mean, I think Roberts has kind of probably blown his season out a little bit now. Lopez is sort of very up and down, and Aguirre's injured. So for me, I think Jake is a genuine, in
Chance.
terms of this year, he is a genuine title contender now, because if the Bosque is kind of starting to lose its advantage, and if the riders, for one reason or another, are slightly, pegged back through injury or psychological things or whatever, yeah, I mean, if Jake keeps winning or podiuming for the rest of the season, which he looks like he could do, 43 points is not that big of a gap, particularly if the guys at the front currently, in terms of Garcia and Aguirre, start to shed big points, that could turn around pretty quickly. So I've got high hopes for Jake Dixon at the moment, but I'm keeping my keeping my enthusiasm under control
I understand.
for now.
Let's see. We were at the Dixon on 40, 43 behind. Audiger's 50 behind. Who knows what's going to happen there? Then it's Vietti, Gonzalez, Canet, and Arbolino. And That is the championship standings there from Moto2. It's the best championship by far. So we shall see. Anyway, okay, let's get to Moto GP and get through the this one's easier to go through. There's not quite as much there.
Not a whole lot to talk about.
Not a whole lot to talk about there. But anyway, if we look at the first qualifying session, Binder, Acosta, Digia, and Bastianini and Miller are all in there. Now, ACO, he was quick early. Then Miller got on top of it. Now we got new tires, and Acosta just blasts past and he gets there. But Binder and Acosta move on. Miller sort of was the odd man out in that sequence. So that's how they get to the second session. You had that heavy rain. The question was, could Mark, who had been dominant in every practice session, led everything, could he win the pole position? And could he do it? Well, basically, he got a little bit of a break because Mr. Poleman himself, Jorge Martin, threw it down the road at turn five on a front end tuck. Again, greasy track because now these guys are qualifying early in the morning, wet patches, very narrow groove, and Jorge winds up tucking the front. He's gone. It was Marc Marquez and Acosta and Bagnaia. They were now on new tires. Those three guys were the fastest from the first half or whatever. But Marc Marquez would go on to take pole position as 94th pole, and then Acosta would be second. So it was like, ooh, the magic of Acosta has suddenly reappeared, been rekindled. Something has changed. He's back into the game. Bagnaia got third and immediately was like, oh, I don't know. As long as it rains tomorrow, we're gonna have a terrible time with the start. Like, okay. Martin was fourth. He got back on his other bike and would be fourth. Then Alex Marquez would be fifth. Morbidelli was sixth. That's how the first two rows would be going off for the sprint later that afternoon. So the question then becomes, what the heck is going to happen in the sprint? Could Mark do it? Could he win a sprint? We've seen him on the podium in the sprints, but what's going to happen here? And the bigger question was, what was going to happen with Bagnaia's start? Because they were, Tardozzi and everybody was very concerned about them starting on the dirty side of the racetrack. And it remained to be seen what would happen. Well, Marquez got the hole shot as expected. Then it was followed by Martin and Acosta, and then Alex Marquez. Aleix would go down at turn one, and Zarco would crack. I didn't say this, but a shout out to Zarco. On the very difficult Honda, he was in the top 10. He didn't have to come through Q1 to get there. He was the first time a Honda had made it to directly to the second qualifying session. Is Zarco finding something in setup? Is Honda getting somewhere? Who knows? Well, I'm just saying that, perhaps maybe with Zarco, they are going to get somewhere, and perhaps there is light at the end of the tunnel. Although I still think the tunnel is very long, very dark, and it's going to take a lot of effort for them to get out of it, if they can at all, until we get rules changes in 27. Anyway, yeah. Morbidelli would fall at turn nine. He would go down. Bagnaia had, the terrible start. He ran wide at turn five. That would let Alex Marquez and Oliveira get by. Bagnaia was just having a terrible time. It seemed as though he had like no real grip. He could get no drive. He couldn't get anything going. Binder and Bagnaia would have a battle there. And they would rage back and forth as to who was going to get what where and all that stuff. So they had a bit of a ding dong back and forth, which was kind of nice to see. Bagnaia, it was very obvious. He had zero faith in the front tire of that motorcycle. Zero. Absolute zero. He was no way, no how did he think that that was ever going to be, he was ever going to have any confidence to go fast there, which was not a good thing to come out of that sprint race and have no confidence in your machine, considering you're gonna have to do this all again tomorrow. And the threat of rain overnight was greater than what it was the previous night. So like, oof, okay, this is not looking good for Bagnaia. Even Quartararo got by Bagnaia, which that's who would have thought the Yamaha would pass the factory Ducati, but it did. But Marc Marquez would win the sprint. Martin rode within himself, which was a good thing, to finish second and take 9 points. Acosta got a podium. That was really great. Then it was Alex Marquez, Oliveira, Brad Binder, Bastianini, who also got by Bagnaia, because Bagnaia would wind up being ninth. Quartararo was sandwiched between the two factory Ducatis, and Bezzecchi was the final guy in 10th. So that was the sprint. The question I think really out of this was, what was going to happen overnight? Was it going to rain? And could Mark do the throuple? That was really what everybody was wondering. Could he win a race? Could Mark win that race? And that was the big question. Anything you want to add there on the sprint, real quick, Rich?
I mean, it wasn't particularly compelling
No.
watching, as I think we've said for a lot of MotoGP this year. The one thing I felt compelled to tweet about after the race, because I did actually watch it on my mobile phone when I was away at the weekend, although I had horrible signal, so it kept buffering. But what the hell is going on with the TV direction? It kind of, I bitch and moan about this from time to time, and it was particularly egregious. So Zarco went down. We never saw how or why or what. Well, Bedelli went down. We didn't really see why or how or what. And then, the sort of the crowning turd in the water pipe, as far as I was concerned, was on the final turn when Bagnaia is battling for that single point or whatever it was for ninth place against Bezzecchi. Final lap, final turn. They're side by side going into that final long left-hander, and the direction cuts away to look at Marc Marquez. He's already gone across the line and he's kind of slowing down and waving to the crowd. And I just think, what happened to the little picture-in-picture thing? Let's at least look, if there's racing going on somewhere down the field, which is something of a rarity in terms of MotoGP, but not, I mean, it applies to Moto2 and Moto3 as well. Then for goodness sake, let's see that. And if you want to watch Marquez waving at the crowd, having taken the victory, which I understand is very significant and is more significant in terms of the Sunday, as we'll come on to. But for goodness sake, I mean, let's at least look at some racing that's going on. So I just found that really frustrating. And, if MotoGP wants to appeal to a wider audience, particularly once Liberty gets involved, then it has to maximize the action when it occurs. And, cutting away from a race on track to somebody who's actually finished the race is not, for me, is not a good strategy for engagement with the excitement of the sport, which we all know is there. So for me, that was the biggest takeaway. And it kind of undermines somewhat Marc Marquez having won the sprint, because we've all been saying all year, can he win a race, any race, whether it's a sprint or a Grand Prix? I personally don't see a great big distinction between the two things, but that's just me. A race is a race. But yeah, I mean, it was a fairly sort of tepid affair, wasn't it, overall? Mainly because of Marc Marquez's brilliance, that has to be said. And I must just say, just because I know you probably won't mention it, Jim, but I did, because I was catching up on Sunday afternoon and Sunday evening, I did actually watch the 10-minute warm-up on sort of catch-up playback as well. And Marquez is so cool because he went out, did one lap on a set of wets just to scrub them in, just in case, and then he parked it for the rest of the warm-up. Rest of the warm up for the last 8 minutes. I mean, it's nothing really. That warm up is hardly worth doing it, but that showed his confidence, really, that he just went out, did a lap, and then sat down and waited for the race to come around. So the race did come around at what, 2 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever it was. So there we go.
All right, let's look at the actual race. I think the idea here was there going to be a tire management race? Because we've seen what had happened. Sort of some of the Moto2 guys had a problem with the Pirellis kind of chewing up the left side. Moto3 had a problem with that as well. Hey, these are Michelins. Are these going to fall prey to the same potential problem that's there? And the question was, can Marquez win the whole darn thing? And we got to remember, because of being paid points in the sprint, Jorge Martin would take a 3-point lead into the race ahead of Bagnaia because of Bagnaia's terrible sprint race where he only gained 1 point. Well, Marquez gets another hole shot. Surprise, surprise, surprise. He's on the good part of the track. Bagnaia just has wheel spin again. That bike was sideways. It was not going in any which direction. I mean, a lot of times you saw a lot of the guys in the Moto2, Moto3 point their bikes the other way to try to get towards that groove because it was just so dirty and dusty and crappy that no one could get anything out of there. Now, I can't imagine why Ducati could not have changed how their launch system works to feather more clutch into it or something, but maybe that was a risk they didn't want to take where they could burn the clutch out of the bike. I don't know how all that all interacts with each other. But you would think that, I mean, I almost thought if I was Benyai, I would want to have my front ride height device engaged. I would want the back end engaged, but I wouldn't want anything else. I would want to be able to feather the clutch all the way myself, because it looked like each time to me that Benyai just threw the clutch like everybody else does when it's perfectly dry track and the bike does the rest. This is one of those times where I don't know, maybe it's just the old dirt tracker and me going, well, hey, you'd want to slip that thing off or start in second or do something different, right? You knew you had that problem the day before. It was worse rain overnight, and you guys didn't do a damn thing to fix it.
Oh,
I couldn't figure it out. I'm like,
Jim,
how?
you've opened up a can of worms here,
Oh,
man.
please, please go ahead.
Well, let's cast our minds back to, oh, golly, now is it 2004, 2005, Qatar with Rossi out on a scooter
Oh,
cleaning up
Jaber
the
now?
dirties.
Okay.
So there's that precedent in terms of they can't really do
Right. You
anything.
can't clean the track.
You can't.
I'm 100% behind that one. You are where you are. My bitch is Ducati didn't, in my mind, maybe they did, but to mine, just they didn't seem to try to reprogram anything.
Well, I would point your attention to Marc Marquez in Austria last week, or the weekend before, where his front ride height device, or the, what do you call it, the hole shot device, didn't engage. And the simple fact that that was not correct meant that he just sank into the mid pack off the start. So there, I mean, there is just no room for any deviation from the norm, is there? And again, because I'd listened to the race podcast over the last couple of days, the guys on there were saying that on the Saturday on the sprint, it looked as if Banyaya just had wheel spin because of dirt on the track, and that might have, in the same way that Jorge Martin had a very similar thing happen in Qatar last November, which he kind of blamed Michelin for, but he had a massive kind of wheel spin off the track, and it kind of did something to the tire that meant that it took a while for that to work its way out or to rectify itself, let's say. Simon Patterson pointed out that on the Sunday morning, I think it was Alex Crivier was doing some demo laps on the NSR
NSR 500.
500 and might have been going down the inside of the track to stay off the racing line, and that might have put some other stuff on the track that caused a different problem in terms of the wheel spin that Banyaya had. Although, and I can't say this with any great certainty because, like most of us, I was watching Banyaya off the first off position three on the grid at the start. I don't know if anybody else, say in sixth or ninth or 12th, i.e. the other people on the inside but further back on the grid, if they had massive wheel spin problems, but I certainly was aware that Banyaya did. So I don't know. I just wonder if it was just one of those kind of perfect storms of everything going wrong for Banyaya this weekend, and it's just a bit of an outlier kind of weekend, and he just has to chalk it down to experience. I mean, obviously things will get worse in the race, as we'll come to in a minute. He just has to move on to his home round, where I strongly suspect he will pick up a lot of points and get back to normal.
What he would get, what do you get for a sprint? You get 12 for a sprint.
12.
So
Yeah, so
24 plus a plus 50 is
it's like 78
72.
points in it or something
Yeah,
like
so
that.
yeah, I wouldn't put it past it anyway. But
He
okay.
will score a lot of points in, unless something really old happens. I mean,
Yeah.
weather,
Who
not
knows?
likely, is it? But
No. Not
yeah.
this time of year. But anyway, so Marquez has that hole shot. Benyai's got the wheel spin. So it's basically Marquez, it's Acosta, it's Alex Marquez, Martin, who had some trouble getting offline, then Morbidelli, Oliveira, and Benyai. Benyai is seventh, okay? So Oliveira goes down at turn 16. Not sure why. Again, bad TV direction. We never did see that crash that happened. Then Martin and Acosta go after each other. at the Corkscrew, and they're both sort of like after each other. They're off the track a little bit. They're like, you can tell that they're trying to tiptoe around each other and not really fall off because they know that they're not on the line and tires are going to be dirty and everything. But Martin does get by, and that puts Martin in second, puts Acosta in third. So it's like, well, okay, maybe Acosta is going to get, you know, a podium finish out of this, which would be very nice to see. You know, but Alex Marquez would get by Acosta. And in fact, Acosta would start to go backwards at this point. Quartararo would fall off at turn five, which let's understand that is an incredibly difficult corner. That is probably one of the trickiest corners of any MotoGP corner on any of the circuits we currently race on, because you're carrying a very high amount of speed out of four heading to five. You're on the side of the tire and you're required to brake and downshift at the same time. And you're going left. So it's your feet are not where they really want them to be either. Yeah. And that, and on a track that was like ice because of the conditions we were on, that turn was insanely, you know, hard, incredibly difficult in the first part. That was one of the things when I was road racing I could never, ever do correctly, was to be going left and then have a very short amount of time to straighten a bike, downshift or whatever, and go left again. Incredibly difficult. Never could figure it out. But that's why I did what I did and why I sit here now, because I couldn't figure that out.
Don't be too hard on yourself, sir.
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that I think after I started, you know, actually watching MotoGP and listening to engines and tactics, a lot of things that I wish I would have known then, now, kind of a thing that it would be, you know, hey, I could do this. But anyway, it's all water.
Can I just say,
yeah,
Jim, as an extremely mediocre motorcycle rider on the roads in the UK, which the roads in the UK are bloody terrible in terms of potholes and crap on them, but the degree to which these riders break on the side of the tire into turns all the way to the apex and then crack open the throttle. I know they've got a lot of electronics and stuff, but God, that's hard to do. I mean, you know, you touch a brake on a bike when you're on the turn and it just wants to sit up. So, I mean, just the physical strength and hats off to these guys. And the fact that more people didn't crash at turn five as Quartararo did is just amazing to me, because you know, that is, as you say, that is probably one of the trickiest turns on the whole calendar. And anybody that rides a bike and has kind of spooked themselves in a turn and suddenly hit the brake by accident or as a reaction to something, and it's the worst thing you can possibly do. You just have to lean harder because the grip is there. But it's just phenomenal to me that what these guys managed to do. And I don't even have the first clue as to what they're doing, because they are, as you said earlier on, the elite of the elite. So, yeah, it's amazing that you don't see more crashes.
Yeah, I was amazed at how crash-free it actually was, to be honest.
Yeah.
But Alex Marquez would move his way to third. Morbidelli was, you know, sort of gaining on Acosta with Benyaya. And, you know, Morbidelli would go wide at five, and then Benyaya would go back to fifth because of Bender there. Well, then Alex Marquez starts to slide back, and we had a pretty good battle for fourth. That was between Acosta and Benyaya. It was good racing. They were trying each other. Acosta goes wide at 16 and Benyaya goes by. Then Benyaya's catching, you know, Alex Marquez for third. And then, you know, we got 10 to go, and it's Mark Marquez, it's Martin, it's Alex. So everybody's talking, hey, another podium for the brothers. You know, this time it's in Spain and da 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 da. And Benyaya is next, you know, he's running fourth, and Acosta and Bender. And then, you know, again, there's a gap here, right? Like Alex Marquez is starting to go backwards slightly. Benyaya is starting to put it together and he's coming forward. But with seven to go, Benyaya was actually on Alex Marquez. And then we get to six to go, and we get to turn 12. Now, you come out of the reverse corkscrew at nine. 10 is this left-hander, followed by 11, which is nothing more than lean the bike over and go through it. It's kind of like Road America with the carousel, out of the carousel and through the kink. The kink is a turn, but it really isn't a turn kind of a thing. And then Alex just goes wide. He just makes the mistake. difficult conditions again. So he makes a mistake. He runs wide. He's starting to come back on, but Benyaya stays online, is underneath of him. Alex then come the two of them as they as Benyaya exits on the correct racing line. As Alex is trying to come back onto the correct racing line, the two of them just bang into each other. And then they get tangled together. Both of them go down. And the scary part is Benyaya is actually under Alex's bike for a pretty good distance as they topple off into the gravel trap. Then it's like, wow, this is now carnage because now we have Benyaya out of this race. And is Benyaya injured? Because he stayed in the gravel trap for a long time before he moved. I didn't think he was gravely injured. It wasn't like, oh, is it like a rainy thing where his back was broken or something like that? I didn't think that. I just thought maybe a foot peg may have got him. You know, I was expecting like a puncture wound of some kind or something like that, just based on how they kind of went into the gravel together. But Benyaya eventually did come to his feet. He did get himself together. I'm sure he had the wind completely knocked out of him. But he did go to the medical center for checkups. And as far as I know, Benyaya is just a bruised and battered puppy. And that's really all that he is. But then it was like, okay, well, what's going to happen to Alex Marquez? You know, these guys were fighting for the same piece of racetrack. And, you know, Alex basically wasn't in a position where he would be, quote, unsighted. Like he couldn't see Benyaya coming, for my take. And Benyaya kind of knew that Alex was out there somewhere because he watched him go off, because there was enough distance between the two of them for Benyaya to actually see that happen. So it's like, okay, I wonder who the stewards are going to appoint blame to each other. Well, they declared that one a racing incident. And I'm going like, and your reasoning was that difficult track conditions followed by the fact that the two riders were fighting for the same piece of tarmac resulted in both riders going down and going off the track. So therefore, no further incident, nothing to see here, people, move on. Wait a second. Joe Roberts and Vietti are going for, on a difficult track, looking for the same piece of ground, and literally you give Joe Roberts a long lap penalty for it. I'm like, the two things in my mind don't add up, and that's my opinion on it. And I'm not trying to be favoritist as an American and Joe as an American. I really didn't see that as any more than good hard racing between the two of them. Just like I can look at what Alex and Benyaya had as good hard racing, and these things happen. Yet somehow, you know, I really thought for sure that they were not going to let Alex off the hook and that they were going to give him some 3-grid penalty or something for knocking the world champion down, because we seem to like to punish outcomes as opposed to actual incidences in what's there. What's your take on all of this one, Rich? Because it is the talking point of this race.
Yeah, and it might well end up being the talking point of the season. Let's not forget. But oh, I don't know, Jim. It's a real can of worms, isn't it? I mean, you might take the view that, as I think I do, that I think on just about on balance, the race direction, or the stewards rather, called the Benyaya Marquez one correctly, by which I mean they probably called the Roberts Vietti one incorrectly, because these things will happen in close combat. I think there is a slight difference, however, in the sense that the Roberts Vietti tangle, I think, happened at the end of the back straight, didn't it?
Yes.
And so you would argue that Roberts was in no way impeded or unsighted when he made that move on Vietti and they made contact and Vietti went off. It didn't crash. Neither of them crashed. But it did cost Vietti time. So I can sort of see why Roberts copped the long lap for that. I think the Benyaya Alex Marquez one is a bit different. I mean, first of all, Alex Marquez didn't go off the track. He went wide, but he only went onto the curb. So he didn't go off the track. And he obviously didn't look behind him, so he didn't know how close behind him Benyaya was. So Marquez did what any rider would do in that situation, and he got back online as quickly as he could, and he went for the apex of the next turn. Benyaya saw the opportunity and went for the outside move, as he would do, and there was no quarter given by either rider. So what was interesting to me was, if you looked at it from the front view versus the rear view, you would take a completely different opinion on the crash, because on one view, it kind of really looked as if Marquez just kind of almost deliberately rode into him. Whereas from the other perspective, it kind of looked like, well, maybe they were both slightly unsighted and they were just going for it to, because they're in a race. I mean, that's what they do. So I personally, after thinking about it a lot, because I knew we were going to be talking about this one a fair bit, I genuinely do think it was a 50-50 job. And at the end of the day, they both fell off. You can argue about the fact that the stewards kind of go after outcomes rather than intent. And because both of them fell off, they both kind of copped a penalty naturally for, I mean, Bagnaia was extraordinarily lucky not to get badly injured. Well, and Marquez, because Marquez actually had a pretty nasty, tumble himself. So he was lucky not to be injured. Bagnaia with the bike on top of him, and particularly with the rear wheel as close to his head as it was. I mean, had that tyre kind of interacted with his crash helmet, given the friction
Oh, yeah.
that a tyre would give when it's spinning on a crash helmet, that doesn't really bear thinking about. So overall, I think once you kind of get over the fandom aspects of this in terms of who you support, who you don't, the fact that both of them walked away relatively unscathed is kind of the big win out of this. And who cops a penalty, who doesn't, is kind of ultimately not that big of a deal. But Bagnaia, again, he lost a lot of points, didn't he, there? And he was certainly going to get third, and it was just unfortunate what happened. But I just do think it was a racing incident.
Yeah, I completely agree.
If
It's a
you're going to be really, really kind of pointed about it, I'd say possibly 55, 60% Alex Marquez and Bagnaia, possibly slightly the innocent party in both of it. But Bagnaia could well have predicted, in full view of what was going on in front of him, that Alex Marquez would go for the corner. So I think for me, that makes it a 50-50. And I think the stewards got that one correct.
I agree. This one was correctly called by the stewards. I can argue that the Roberts one is not correct by the stewards. But it is what it is. It is racing, and these things happen. This is sort of kind of smacks of Bagnaia escaping from Catalunya, having been hit by Brad Binder and not having only a deep bruise on his thigh or his lower leg or whatever. It's sort of the same thing. Bagnaia has a very bad crash that he then is very lucky to have escaped any kind of an injury to. So it's like, well, okay, I guess Bagnaia's got to have one crash per year where he almost gets injured to be able to carry on to win a championship, because it's that way. That's the incident. But now it's what you expect then, is the fact that Marc Marquez wins. It's 1,043 days since his last victory in a MotoGP race, not a sprint. Let's be clear about that. Martin rides home to second, which was good on him, which now he has a 23-point lead in the world championship. Acosta gets a podium sort of by luck, but he did right the ship. You got to give Acosta credit. He did go backwards. He righted the ship. He got back in it, and he kind of used Bagnaia as a tool to help him get further up, which is what a smart rider would do. Binder then is the second KTM to cross the line. Then Bastianini, Morbidelli, Bezzecchi, DiGiantonio, Rins, Aleix, Taka Nakagami, Augusto Fernandez, Zarco with a 13th, Mir with a 14th, and Miller 15th. I don't know what happened to Jack, because he was never on the screen, but that is the race. That takes us to the championship. Now, Martin is on 299. He's, as I said, he is 23 points ahead of Bagnaia. We're going to Bagnaia's backyard. Yeah, I don't see Martin winning anything there. But if at worst, if everything were to play out, I think you'd only have five, you'd gain 8 points a race. So even if Martin finished second both times, it'd be 16 points that he would get. Essentially gain on Martin. So it's gonna cut it down to essentially you was 16, seven point championships or something, 7 points, 17 points, something like that.
This
If that
one's
worked
going all
out.
the way to the end.
This
To
one is going to be to the
Valencia, I
very end.
think.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think this one's going to. I think there's going to be a lot of back and forth that's going to happen here as we head through it. But Marquez, as in Mark, now is on only 70 points shy of the leader. And so he's third. Bastianini is, he leapt over Bastianini, who had, you know, that good run of form there for a smidge by 1 point. And then Acosta is now fifth in the championship. He's the best KTM because he's ahead of Binder. Then Vinales, Aleix, you know, it's weird that Vinales is ahead of Aleix, but he is. Then DiGiantonio, and then Alex Marquez is 10th in the championship. A wacky and crazy race just because total elation because Marquez won. I mean, this is one of the greatest comebacks in motorcycling history. It's on that George Foreman, Tyson, not Foreman. Who was it? You said Rich Tyson.
Muhammad Ali, George Foreman.
Ali Foreman fight, right? It's in that vein. I propose that it's in the same vein as Mick Doohan having almost lost his leg, almost lost his right leg to come back and win five titles on the trot. But you could make the argument that Marquez's competitors are vastly more talented than what Doohan's title challengers were at the time. The 500s were a nasty beast, and it took a special person to ride them. And it did take a special person, though, you know, again, Crevier was 99 world champion some 25 years ago, but also Doohan broke his shoulder too at that time. So it took Crevier basically 3.5 years to figure out how to ride a 500 as fast as Doohan did. So I don't know. It's a phenomenal thing that Marquez had the problem he had with his arm. I mean, good grief. They rotated the bone 30 degrees and put it back together again. And he's won a MotoGP race. It is an ominous shot across the bow of Bagnaia of, look, buddy, if I get on the same bike you have, you're going to have me to deal with as well as Martin. And that's going to be wild. Although Martin being on an Aprilia is going to really throw a wrench in things next year. So this is just mouthwatering to say the least.
I know we've got to wrap this up, Jim, so I'll be brief. I mean, I admire Marquez. I've always been very clear of just the fact that I've never been a huge Mark Marquez fan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not really a huge fan of anybody in particular. I kind of like
Alex Rins
the most, but I don't know why, just probably because of the Suzuki thing going back a while. But what I particularly admire about Marquez, as well as his kind of coming back from that injury, which, let's be honest, that was a career-ending injury, and it would have put most people out permanently. So his, you know, his will to win and to continue is really impressive. But not only that, I mean, and this is what for me distinguishes him from most other riders, is that he went through that incredibly difficult period with Honda when he came back, which kind of culminated in that famous sort of Saxon ring, Nadir, or whatever you want to call it, last July, August, whenever it was. And from there, he kind of bought himself out of his contract. Okay, you can quite rightly say he could easily afford to do it, but he's jumped on another bike, and an inferior bike in terms of its specification, because we know the GP23 is way, way behind the 24. It's way behind the 23 that ended last season. And he has now won on it, and he's got himself the plum position in the work squad for next year. So it's kind of like tick, 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 tick all the way along, isn't it, in terms of job done for him. So as much as I kind of find some of his tactics and some of his behavior, I mean, what the whole kind of putting his crash helmet on and dancing to the DJ on the podium thing is about, don't get me started on that. I just find that kind of, I don't know how to describe it really, just kind of like, just cheese inducing kind of cringe levels for me. But that's because of my age, I suppose. I'm just out of tune. But putting all that to one side, he's a phenomenal competitor. and a phenomenal kind of physical kind of, yeah, I don't know how to describe it really, but it is, for me, it is genuinely out there with the whole Ali Foreman thing, that kind of comeback story against the odds. It's phenomenal what he's done, you know, and nobody should underestimate it. And if he jump, if that 25 Ducati is anywhere close to what we suspect it will be, and it will be good, let's be honest, because you know Ducati are just kind of like honing in on these this current set of regulations. He's going to be hard to contain next year. He, you know, he does crash a fair bit, but he wins a lot when he's on form, and he's coming back onto form. So next year is going to be crazy. The only other thing I want to say, Jim, before we close this thing out, is Aprilia. What the hell happened to Aprilia? I mean, I'm surprised we've not had an email from Gary this week, because I mean, Maverick parked it up in the race. That's how bad things were. Now, we know the Aprilia loves high grip, and we were the absolute opposite of high grip this weekend in Aragon. There was no grip whatsoever, but it was just a horror show for Aprilia. So I don't know what to say, really. I mean, I've got Maverick still on my fantasy team. Bit of a mistake, really, because I'm just hemorrhaging points as a result of that. So, yeah, Gary, write in, give it both barrels, because you've got all the justification to do so at the minute. But yeah, it was, you know, interesting weekend.
Yeah,
And we move on to Misano.
I think you said it all correctly. I agree with you 100%. It is phenomenal to watch this. Next year will be probably even more phenomenal to see what happens. Looking forward to the double at Misano and see where that all shapes up. Given the fact that it's tight and twisty, I kind of give, and Marquez has that boost to having one. You got to think he's going to be in the mix, at least in the podium somewhere. The question is, can he run interference for Bagnaia and take Martin? Don't know. Going to be interesting to watch. Going to be great fun for the weekend there. I think that's it for the show, Rich. Write us in as Jacob has at motopod at motopodcast.com. You can connect with Rich at Richard Jowett on Instagram, Threads, Twitter, X, whatever the kids are calling it today. I'm at MotoRGV, same three things. And with that, I will remind you all to ride safe.
Cheerio.